Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, June 17, 2016, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call. As today, we discuss Tuesday's D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals net neutrality decision. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome back return teleforum guests, Adam White and Brett Shumate. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of them. We're going to hear from Brett Shumate and then Adam White and then Brett Shumate again. But as always, we'll be turning to the audience for your questions, so please do be ready with those. Brett Shumate is a partner at Wiley Ryan right here in Washington, D.C. Adam White, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution. With that, let's go right to the program. Brett Shumate, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. Thank you for having me. Just in the interest of full disclosure, I just want to let everybody know that I did represent some of the petitioners in the net neutrality case. So I'm here expressing my own personal views today, not those of my clients, so take that with a grain of salt. But Adam and I discussed what we might do today, and I think what I'll do is just give an overview of the case and some of the context and the key holdings by the court on Tuesday. We'll turn things over to Adam to talk about some of the implications and important things that he sees out of the case, and then turn back to me to talk about a few other things. So with that, let me give a little overview of the context of the court's decision on Tuesday. This was the FCC's third attempt to regulate the internet or adopt open internet or net neutrality rules. And it's the third case coming out of the DC Circuit involving the FCC's attempts to do so. The first case was Comcast versus FCC in 2010. Second case was Verizon versus FCC in 2014. In response to that decision from the D.C. Circuit, the FCC adopted the 2015 Open Internet Order, in which the FCC reclassified broadband internet access service as a Title II telecommunications service and also adopted new open internet or net neutrality rules regulating broadband internet access service providers. This decision by the D.C. Circuit on Tuesday was reviewing multiple petitions for review of the FCC's decision from 2015, and in short, the D.C. Circuit rejected all of the petitions for review and all of the challenges to the FCC's order. And there were six key holdings in the case, and I'll just briefly tick through those, and then Adam can pick up and explain in more detail a couple of the issues that he sees in the court's decision. But really, the first big issue that the court had to address was whether the FCC reasonably classified or reclassified broadband as a Title II telecom service rather than an information service. Under the Communications Act, telecom services are subject to Title II of the Communications Act, and information services are not. The question before the court was a similar question that was before the Supreme Court in Brand X, a 2005 Supreme Court decision that upheld the FCC's decision to classify cable broadband internet access service as a Title I information service. The court in this decision on Tuesday held that the FCC had reasonably explained why it reclassified broadband as a Title II telecom service. The court said that the statute was ambiguous. The Supreme Court had resolved that question in Brand X, and that consumers perceive broadband as a standalone telecom service, and consumers purchase broadband for that purpose, to access third-party content on the internet. As a result, because the broadband internet access services are now Title II telecom services, it unlocks Title II of the Communications Act for the FCC to regulate these services under its broadest authority under Title II. The second question that the court addressed were interconnection arrangements, which are really how the internet works in the backbone. ISPs will connect with other ISPs and other backbone providers and even edge providers like Netflix to pass internet traffic back and forth. And what the FCC decided in the Open Internet Order was that those relationships are also subject to Title II of the Telecom Act. The FCC didn't apply any rules to that to those arrangements, but did say that it would exercise its Title II authority to review disputes in case there are disputes about interconnection arrangements. And the court found no problem with the FCC's regulation of interconnection arrangements, and found that there was no notice and comment problem, and there was no failure of reasoned explanation by the FCC. The third key holding in the case was a very complex one involving mobile broadband internet access services, which are subject to a different statutory regime under the Telecom Act. What the FCC decided in 2015 was that mobile broadband access services that you access through your handset are also telecom services, but in addition, commercial mobile services, which put them under the same regulatory treatment as Title II telecom services. Before, the FCC had previously classified these services as private services, which were exempt from common carriage regulation under Title II. Here, the court also said once again that the FCC had reasonably explained its decision to redefine what it means to be an interconnected service that interconnects with the public switch network. In doing so, the court found no notice and comment problem with the FCC's action and no failure to explain reasonably what the commission was doing. The fourth key issue that the court addressed was forbearance. After the FCC had reclassified broadband as a Title II service, the FCC decided to forbear from multiple aspects of Title II. So it kept the core provisions of Title II, such as Sections 201 and 202, but granted forbearance from many other irrelevant provisions of Title II that were really intended for telephone service. And here the court rejected the challengers' attacks on the FCC's forbearance rationale. The court found no procedural or substantive problem with the FCC's decision to basically drop out most of Title II, but subject broadband providers to the core provisions of Title II. The fifth key grouping of issues that the court addressed were specific challenges to the open internet rules, and in particular, two of the rules. One was the paid prioritization rule, which prohibits ISPs from entering into arrangements with edge providers like Netflix to grant faster treatment to certain internet content. And the second challenge was to the general conduct standard, which was alleged by the petitioners to be a vague standard by which the FCC would judge future conduct that's not prohibited by the bright line net neutrality rules. And here the court said, with respect to the paid prioritization rule, that Section 706 of the Telecom Act of 96 authorized the paid prioritization rule and rejected a vagueness due process challenge to the general conduct standard. So the court upheld all of the open internet rules in addition to the reclassification of broadband under Title II. And finally, the court addressed the First Amendment. There was a First Amendment challenge by two of the petitioners. They were alleging that the open internet rules in particular restricted ISPs' free speech rights to decide what content should be transmitted over the internet and how that content should be transmitted. And the court rejected the First Amendment challenge, finding that the First Amendment did not apply at all to ISPs because they are not engaged in speech when they act as neutral conduits for the transmission of third-party speech. There was also a separate dissent by Senior Judge Williams. It was a partial dissent, partial concurrence, that was 70 pages in length. And he focused on three key issues in his separate opinion. One, he believed that the FCC had failed to reasonably explain the change in reclassification, and he found a problem under the Supreme Court's decision in Fox, which says that the agency must reasonably explain the reasons why it's changing its policies. And Judge Williams had a very detailed market power and economic view on the case and why the FCC had failed to reasonably explain or address all the key facts that have changed, the investment reliance on the FCC's previous reclassification decisions. The second issue that Judge Williams focused on was the paid prioritization rule. In a lengthy part of the opinion, he explained why he thought the FCC's attempt to regulate differential pricing arrangements was contrary to the Title II of the Communications Act and not authorized by Section 706 of the Telecom Act. And the final issue that Judge Williams focused on was the forbearance issues. He didn't think the FCC had reasonably explained why it could pick and choose which parts of Title II to apply to broadband but allow others to remain. So with that, I think that's an overview of the court's holding. I think all of these issues we could focus on for an entire hour, but I'm going to kick things over to Adam to explain what he thought were some of the key takeaways from the court's decision.
Well, thanks, Brett. Like Brett, I'll note up front that in addition to my work as a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, I was on the legal team representing some interveners in this case, challenging the FCC's policy, namely the group of interveners led by Tech Freedom, a public policy advocacy organization, a cloud computing company called Carry.net, and a number of internet entrepreneurs led by Jeff Pulver. I did this in my capacity as a counsel at Boyd & Gray & Associates. I'm still of counsel to Boyd & Gray & Associates and still with the firm involved in this case. Now, in this case, obviously attention was focused first and foremost, both by the public and the court, on the fundamental issues of telecommunications law, the Communications Act of 34 and the Telecom Act of 96. But this case did have some broader questions undergirding it, and not just the constitutional issues that Brett will speak to, the First Amendment questions, but also more fundamental questions of administrative law and separation of powers and the relationship between the courts, Congress, and the agency. Now, we had a similar example of this a couple of years ago in the King v. Burwell case, the last big challenge to implementation of the Affordable Care Act, where the case was mostly about the Affordable Care Act, but there was a pretty significant administrative law question at the outset, namely how to apply Chevron deference in that case. And we thought that there was a similar issue in this case. Before the court can interpret the statute, before it could decide to apply or not apply Chevron deference, it needs to decide whether the Chevron deference framework applied at all. This is what's known as the Chevron Step Zero. Most people think of Chevron as two steps. The first step, you ask, is the statute unambiguous? And the second step is, well, if the statute's ambiguous, then the court should defer to an agency's reasonable interpretation of the statute. But Chevron Step Zero asks the more fundamental question about whether the Chevron framework applies at all or whether the court should set the framework aside and just interpret the statute for itself. The court should do it for itself, applying the traditional tools of statutory construction without any regard for the Chevron framework. Now, in this case, the interveners, Tech Freedom, and the others identified a couple of reasons why the Chevron framework should not apply at all. And the first one was drawn directly from Chief Justice Roberts' majority opinion in King v. Burwell. As you may recall, that was a complicated administrative law case, but at the very outset, the Chief Justice said that the court would not apply Chevron deference at all because the issue before the court, the way that the subsidies for health insurance, the subsidies and penalties worked in that case, was a question of such immense economic and political significance that the Chevron framework was just simply inapplicable. The court would not assume that Congress had intended to delegate interpretive authority for such important issues to the agency rather than to the courts. Now, this is known as the major questions doctrine. And so our first argument, the intervener's first argument in this case, was that the same logic applies here, that regulation of the internet is so important, both politically, economically, culturally, a point that even the FCC stresses from the very beginning of its orders, that it's implausible that Congress had intended to commit these statutory interpretation questions to the agencies rather than the courts. And so we argued Chevron shouldn't apply. We had a second argument as to why at Chevron Step Zero, the court should find that Congress didn't delegate interpretive authority to the agencies. And it comes back to another major case called Whitman, a big Clean Air Act case from 2001, where the court said, the Supreme Court said, even in ruling in favor of the EPA eventually on the merits, the court said, if there's a non-delegation doctrine problem at issue in the case, then the Chevron framework doesn't apply. Only the court can resolve non-delegation problems in the implementation of the statute, not the agency. So those were our Chevron Step Zero arguments in the case, why Chevron shouldn't apply. But even if Chevron should apply, we said, there were at least three reasons why the FCC's statutory interpretation in reclassifying broadband internet access service as a telecommunications service, why that statutory interpretation was just completely untenable under the canons of construction. The first one was, again, the major questions doctrine. Like the court said in the big tobacco case from a couple decades ago, Brown and Williamson, or as the D.C. Circuit said more recently in a case involving tax preparers called Loving versus United States. Again, if you have a question of utmost political or economic significance, it's not the sort of thing for which Congress is going to just glibly delegate substantive regulatory power to an agency without a clear statement conveying that delegation of power. So we said the FCC statutory interpretation is untenable because it gives the agency immense power over a question of major political economic significance. Our second argument as to why the agency's statutory interpretation was untenable, it went to a more recent case from the EPA called Utility Air Regulatory Group. That was one of the greenhouse gas cases in which the EPA tried to impose a greenhouse gas regulation program, but in doing so, they had to what they called tailor or unenforce massive parts of the statutory framework. And the Supreme Court rejected that in an opinion for the court written by the late Justice Scalia. Justice Scalia said that the fact that the agency had to unenforce so much of the statutory framework should have made clear to the agency in the first place that its underlying statutory interpretation was wrong. And then our third argument as to why the FCC's statutory interpretation was untenable here went to a 1980s Supreme Court case called the Benzene case. In that case, the Supreme Court said if an agency asserts massive regulatory power without showing that the assertion of this regulatory power is needed to prevent an actual significant risk of harm to the public, then that statutory interpretation is untenable because it assumes that Congress would delegate immense power to an agency for no good reason. And in this case, the net neutrality case, we argued that the FCC, while they identified a number of hypothetical risks to the public, didn't actually show concrete evidence of a risk of harm that required right now this assertion of immense regulatory power. And so we argued that, the third reason why the FCC's statutory interpretation was untenable. Now, the court either rejected these arguments or didn't respond to them. First and foremost, the D.C. Circuit said that our challenge to the Chevron framework, the Chevron Step Zero question, just didn't apply in this case, that the Chevron framework definitely applied, and in fact that the statute is definitely ambiguous, and therefore the court should defer under Chevron Step Two. And the reason why the D.C. Circuit said that here is because of the case Brand X a few years ago, where the Supreme Court, looking at the Communications Act, the court affirmed the FCC's policy at the time because the court saw ambiguities in the Communications Act. In this case, the petitioners argued unsuccessfully that actually Brand X didn't control, that Brand X, the Supreme Court's analysis in Brand X pertained only to a very specific issue with respect to broadband internet, namely what's called the last mile, the transmission of data from your internet service provider to your computer in your home or wherever without any modification. And that in this case, what the FCC was doing went far beyond the last mile and instead went to broadband internet access service as a whole, everything that happens between your internet service provider and the companies creating the content that internet service provider is ultimately sending to you. The analogy that's often used is a pizza delivery company. The last mile is the pizza company delivering the pizza from the restaurant to your house. Everything that happens before that, the making of the pizza, the delivery of the ingredients, and so on, that's not the last mile. Judge Tatel's majority opinion in the D.C. Circuit said that the reasoning of Brand X really covered the entire provision of broadband and internet access service, and not just the last mile. Quite frankly, and again, I represent a party in the case, so I'm hardly an unbiased observer on this point, but I do think the D.C. Circuit may have gone a bit too breezily through this aspect of the analysis. And it's a point that the court warned against in a major Clean Water Act case a few years ago called Rapanos. plurality opinion, again by the late Justice Scalia, where they warned that just because a statute might be ambiguous in one aspect or in one application doesn't mean it's ambiguous in every aspect and in every application. So just because the Supreme Court said in Brand X that the Communication Act is ambiguous as applied to the last mile of internet access service doesn't mean that its provisions are ambiguous with respect to broadband internet access as a whole. Now, another argument that I've discussed that Judge Tatel rejected was the utility air regulatory group argument, the argument that because the FCC had to exercise what it called massive forbearance, not enforcing massive swaths of the Communications Act in order to make its new regulatory framework for broadband internet access plausible and not ruinous. We had argued that was a reason why the statutory interpretation was wrong from the beginning. Judge Tatel said for the majority here, no, that's completely different. In this case, the FCC has statutory authority to forbear, to not enforce parts of the statute. The EPA didn't have that express authority in the case where the Supreme Court struck down its approach. Now, that wasn't quite the intervener's argument in this case. We never argued that the FCC can't forbear, just as in the Utility Air Regulatory Group case. Nobody argued that the EPA couldn't forbear from exercising small parts of the statute. Our argument was that the EPA's repeated assertion of the need to undertake massive, in its words, forbearance to adapt the Communications Act to the 21st century, that combined effect should have caused the EPA to recognize that its underlying statutory interpretations were untenable. Now, Judge Williams' dissent in this case seemed to recognize that slightly different argument. He followed it through to its conclusion and found that the agency's approach in exercising forbearance raised significant questions of whether the agency was arbitrary and capricious here. We even phrased our argument as a Chevron argument, but the upshot is basically the same. Now, again, like I said at the outset, first and foremost, this is a case about telecommunications law and telecommunications policy, but these administrative law issues, though a bit less concrete, are important in the context in which they arise, which I can get to later, which is sort of a broader rethinking and new debates about modern administrative law and whether the old doctrines still map on accurately and usefully to administration and administrative laws that's actually practiced. But I think I've already said enough, so I'll hand it back to Brett at this point.
Thanks, Adam. I'd like to turn your attention to the one constitutional issue in the case, which was the First Amendment, which I think it was a tail issue in the court's opinion, the last issue the court addressed, because you generally don't need to reach a constitutional question if there's other grounds to vacate the agency's action. But here I think the court reached a major constitutional ruling that warrants some attention. So let me just back up and explain a little bit about what the petitioners were arguing in terms of the First Amendment and why that claim was relevant. The petitioners were arguing that the open internet rules, not reclassification, but the rules themselves regulate speech, because what ISPs do are they create some of their own content, but primarily they transmit third-party speech. Your ISP connects you to Netflix and delivers that to your house. Provides all kinds of video content, other types of content. It's all speech over the internet, and your ISP is the one that controls that and exercises discretion about whether to allow that into your home or not. And the argument or analogy that the petitioners were making is that ISPs are just like cable companies. Cable companies, which was their First Amendment rights were addressed in the Turner cases from the mid-1990s. The Supreme Court said that there's no question here that a cable company engages in and transmits speech because they create some of their own content and they exercise control over their repertoire, what they decide to put in a cable package. And there's really no question that the First Amendment applies here. The analogy that the petitioners were making was that ISPs do the same thing. They engage in speech. They create websites. They create video streaming services of their own, and they transmit speech, just like a cable operator. Cable operator, for example, will provide HBO to its cable customers, and they also provide access to the HBO app to the customer on their iPad app. So the argument the petitioners were making was that it's the same content generally transmitted to the home over the same wire. The First Amendment should apply equally to ISPs and cable operators. And in fact, the petitioners were arguing that every other form of mass media, mass communications, has been protected from government control by the First Amendment. It goes for cable, satellite television, broadcasting, newspapers, movie theaters, bookstores. They're all means to the printing press. They're all means to distribute third-party communications. And the petitioners were using those analogies to argue to the D.C. Circuit that ISPs are no different. The D.C. Circuit saw it differently. The court viewed ISPs as telephone companies. And their reasoning was that ISPs are now classified as common carriers, subject to traditional common carriage obligations. Those obligations have never been thought to raise any First Amendment question because common carriers are required to act as neutral conduits for the transmission of speech. The open internet rules are traditional common carriage obligations. They require equal access and non-discrimination. Therefore, there's no First Amendment problem here. I think it's a very significant holding by the court for a couple of reasons. One is that the court didn't recognize any constitutional limit on the FCC's ability to regulate the transmission of content over the internet. Like I said, every other form of mass communication has been cloaked in some type of some level of First Amendment protection. Broadcasting generally received less First Amendment protection than cable or newspapers, but the First Amendment applies to them nonetheless. But the D.C. Circuit in this case found no constitutional limitation on the FCC to regulate the open internet because ISPs do not engage in speech. I think that has significant implications because it all turned, the entire analysis turned on the common carriage label. If the FCC were to, for example, apply that label to other forms of media or impose those common carriage obligations on, for example, a broadcaster or a cable company, the implication of the court's ruling is that that would not raise any First Amendment problem at all because they're common carriage obligations and therefore there's no First Amendment problem here. I think it also suggests some problem with how other platforms, internet platforms, will claim First Amendment protection in the future. Really what ISPs do, according to the court, is they just transmit third-party speech. They're just a neutral conduit. Well, you can think of other internet companies that perform really the same role. Think of Facebook or YouTube or Twitter. They are internet platforms created by companies to allow third parties to post their own speech or communicate with others. It's unclear what the basis for those companies to claim First Amendment protection would be if all they are doing is acting as a neutral conduit for others' speech. Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, they all have policies that allow them to take offensive content down, but ISPs generally do as well. So it's going to be interesting to see how the law develops after this in terms of protecting other internet speech in light of this ruling by the court that the First Amendment doesn't protect ISPs. The other interesting thing about the First Amendment analysis was the exceptions that the court recognized in its own holding. While the court said generally the First Amendment doesn't apply to ISPs, it found two circumstances where the First Amendment would apply. One would be where an ISP offers its own content, that is like a news or weather site, and the court said when they do that, they're entitled to the protections of the First Amendment, but so long as it's separate from their function as a neutral conduit of that of other speech. And that's a really interesting recognition by the court because in Turner, the Supreme Court recognized that cable companies are speakers protected by the First Amendment because they engage in speech. Here, the court in the D.C. Circuit said that, likewise, ISPs engage in speech, but they are not entitled to the protections of the First Amendment when they transmit that speech. And what one of the rules does, the paid prioritization rule in particular, it prohibits an ISP from preferring its own content over the internet. So in the example that the court gave in terms of a news or weather site, the ISP is prohibited from, under the rules, prioritizing their own news or weather site over competing sites. And the court would, under the court's rationale, there would be no First Amendment activity involved in that decision by an ISP to prefer or select its own content and prefer it over other third-party websites. The really interesting exception adopted by the court was that the court recognized that if a broadband provider, quote, nonetheless were to choose to exercise editorial discretion, for instance, by picking a limited set of websites to carry and offering that service as a curated internet experience, it might then qualify as a First Amendment speaker, end quote. So what the court is saying is that generally when an ISP signs up and becomes a broadband internet access service provider, they are promising their customers that they will not block or prioritize or throttle other content. And if an ISP wants to do that, those activities, those are not protected speech, even though the ISP might not agree with the content that they're transmitting, or they may want to prioritize their own content. That is not a sufficient exercise of editorial discretion to implicate the First Amendment. But the court says if the ISP would choose to exercise editorial discretion by creating something like a walled garden like the old AOL that only offers a limited access to content, that would be protected by the First Amendment. It's unclear what the doctrinal rationale for that distinction would be. At bottom, it suggests that the First Amendment is implicated when an ISP does a lot of blocking, but not a little blocking. I think that's a very interesting approach by the court. And finally, that exception, I think, will run contrary to the very purpose of net neutrality. If the court has created an exception here where ISPs are not subject to the open internet rules and are protected by the First Amendment when they, you know, create a limited internet experience, a curated internet experience, then that's exactly what ISPs are going to be encouraged to do to avoid the rules and invoke the protections of the First Amendment. So that is the very antithesis of net neutrality, and I don't think the FCC had thought through the implications or the court about what kind of behavior that's going to encourage. So I think those are the kind of the significant things from the First Amendment analysis by the court that really warrant attention and are going to require a lot of study going forward by a lot of folks. Dean, I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Let's open it up to the audience. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either or even both of our experts, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. Let me remind our audience that next week is the penultimate week of opinions for the Supreme Court this term. We, of course, don't know exactly which decisions are going to come out, but we will be scheduling telephone conference calls to cover the most important among those decisions. Today, of course, we're talking with Brett Shumate and Adam White about the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals net neutrality decision. If you'd like to ask a question, push the star button, then the pound button. While we're waiting to see who rings in, let me get us started here. If either of you want to venture a guess, what is next for the FCC now that this is, maybe it's not completely behind them, but maybe you could venture a guess as to what's next for the FCC in terms of its regulatory regime.
Sure, I can take a first crack at that, Dean. I think the FCC is well on its way and got started well before the D.C. Circuit ruled in terms of taking its next steps after the net neutrality decision. What the FCC is engaged in right now is a rulemaking involving internet privacy, and that rulemaking is contingent on the D.C. Circuit upholding the reclassification of broadband as a Title II service, because the FCC is now relying on one of the particular specific provisions of Title II, which is Section 222, which governs privacy for telephone companies, is now trying to tweak that statute and now apply it to the internet context. And I think the FCC is going to confront a lot of challenges in trying to come up with a reasonable regime for the internet based on a statute that was created for telephone companies. So that's what the FCC is doing right now in terms of rulemaking. The other thing the FCC is looking at, through rulemaking, but almost through its enforcement or policymaking powers, is zero rating services, which have gotten a lot of attention. These are services like T-Mobile's Binge On, and other services, other carriers have them as well. These are services where the ISP chooses not to charge data charges against their customers, gives away free data for access to certain content. So, for example, Binge On exempts MLB at-bat data charges from data caps. And so what the FCC is doing is looking at those practices and trying to decide whether they comply with the open internet rules, and in particular the general conduct rule that was upheld by the D.C. Circuit. So I think those are the two areas that we'll likely see a lot of attention this year that are kind of net neutrality related.
You know, I'm you know, not a telecom law practitioner at you know, to nearly the same extent as Brett. But for what it's worth, one thing that we sort of thought through in our own approach to this case, my colleagues at Point & Gray and Associates, and we've seen debate on elsewhere, is how and to what extent the FCC's approach to net neutrality might reach the so-called edge providers, edge service providers. These are companies like Netflix and others that interface with the public, that help organize access to the internet and content. Because the FCC has been pretty one-sided in their approach, as I understand it. They've focused so much attention on net neutrality with respect to broadband and internet access service, but not with respect to edge services. And I've seen some news stories this spring, complaints and other concerns raised about the FCC's pretty one-sided approach on this. An article in Ars Technica about the cable industry's complaints about Netflix basically practicing non-neutral treatment of its services. It'll be interesting to see the FCC, you know, face these challenges and puzzle through this and try to justify their particular notions of neutrality with respect to one set of industry participants, while taking a much more relaxed and, libertarian approach to other aspects of this industry. It'll be interesting to see how the FCC attempts to square that circle, or even whether the FCC admits that it is trying to square a circle.
Well, Adam, I think you raise a great point that I think it's going to come to a head in this privacy proceeding that I just mentioned, where the FCC is trying to create a privacy framework for the internet, but it only applies to ISPs, not edge providers like Google and Facebook and Amazon, other internet companies that are also involved in tracking customer data and using customer data. The FCC is proposing to apply rules that restrict those practices only to ISPs, but not to other internet companies that engage in the same practices and that are subject to the FTC's regulatory framework. And you can already see some of the basis for a legal challenge already being built in the proceeding about the FCC treating very similarly situated entities differently by applying rules that apply to one set of participants in the internet economy, but not another set of participants that are doing exactly the same thing.
And related to that, in addition to, say, the cable industry raising these complaints, so much of the net neutrality debate so far was, the product of, scholars, pro-net neutrality scholars, and consumer groups and other industry groups that, for purposes of this this policy, were pretty well aligned with the edge providers like Netflix and Google. It'd be interesting to see what happens if there comes a point where those same scholars, the pro-net neutrality scholars, or some of the consumer groups started to turn their fire against the edge providers, effectively splitting that coalition by going to the FCC and asking the FCC to impose these sorts of restrictions on those edge providers. I mean, again, Brett follows this much more closely than I do. My understanding is that hasn't started yet, but I could be wrong. But it seems to me only a matter of time before that coalition starts to divide between those who want neutrality in all or many contexts and others who just want neutrality, so to speak, in this one context.
We do have a couple callers with questions now, but let me ask a quick follow-up question, if I could. Brett Shumate, you mentioned the regulations that FCC might now engage in. Is that going to be a notice and comment rulemaking process? And what does that look like in light of what I understand happened here, where the FCC seemed to be headed in a non-net neutrality direction, published a proposed rule on that, and then sort of at the 11th hour, reverse direction, raising the argument whether or not there had been adequate notice and comments, whether they were considered.
Yeah, Dean, the rulemaking is ongoing right now. The commission had received the first set of comments, I think, last month. Reply comments are due, I think, later this month. So the proceeding is ongoing. It's on track, I think, to I'm sure the commission wants to get these final rules out by the end of this year. And it really is a remarkably large proceeding. There's a lot of things involved in this privacy proceeding that are internet-related but not necessarily privacy-related. For example, the commission is proposing to ban arbitration clauses in ISP contracts, consumer contracts. So there's a lot of things worth watching in that proceeding.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Two callers with questions. Let's take our first call of the day.
Hi, this is Neil Chilson. I work for Commissioner Olhausen at the Federal Trade Commission. And one of the things that I've been hearing about the decision was the sort of, like many things in the majority, a sort of a cursory dismissal and deference to the agency. But could one of you touch on the arbitrary and capricious argument? There's a mention in there that says essentially that U.S. Telecom didn't preserve that argument, and I'm having trouble teasing that out mentally about what the majority is saying there, especially since they seem to think that the commission preserved a lot of things with very cursory inquiries in the NPRM. So I understand those are probably different legal standards, but could one or both of you touch on that point?
I'll take a stab first. This is Brett Shumate. I think the court did give pretty short shrift to a lot of the arbitrary and capricious arguments. And as Adam has explained, I mean, the court's opinion is really cloaked in a prism of deference. I did notice there were a lot of places where the court almost criticized the parties a little bit for not developing arguments, which is highly ironic because the court had a very strict briefing schedule in this case where all the parties, there were at least a dozen petitioners and multiple interveners on each side that were trying to have their arguments heard, and we all had to coordinate the briefing, and there was a very limited amount of words to go around. So to the extent some arguments aren't fully developed, I think that explains why.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, the D.C. Circuit in particular really, really institutionally seems to prefer highly efficient, streamlined litigation through the consolidation of parties and briefs and under pretty strict briefing word limits. And so, you know, even though I wasn't involved in the petitioner coalition and read the briefs as an outsider, you could tell they tried to pack a lot in as much as they could as efficiently as possible in order to keep all the preserved issues in play and preserve as many issues as possible. And it is a little ironic to see them criticized after the fact for allegedly giving too short shrift to certain arguments.
We have one question remaining and still some time left. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's check in with another caller.
Yes, Joseph Lozowski with 21st Century Telecommunications Initiative. I've worked for Inside Counsel for AT&T and a number of providers, but what I find interesting in this view and the forbearance issues on these matters where the FCC is looking to regulate in some aspects, but in other cases they're not. And then if you go up to a broader light, maybe Brett, you could talk about this, basically, right now you have AT&T in a number of states, Kentucky and California, actually using their lobbyists to petition changes in regulatory affairs in terms of VoIP. So they want to classify as a broadband Title II type service. So there would be no additional remediation through the public utility commissions or things like that. Any thoughts on that? Or
yeah, this is Brett. Not necessarily what's going on outside of the court's opinion, but I thought it was interesting that Adam brought up earlier the UARG and the tailoring argument that the petitioners and interveners were pressing, really to use forbearance as an example of how unreasonable the FCC's decision was to reclassify under Title II, but then you acknowledge that the statute doesn't fit because you have to tailor the statute by forbearing. And the majority swatted that argument away by saying, unlike in that case, the FCC has an explicit grant of authority to forbear from certain statutes. So, the fact that Title II now looks like Swiss cheese is not a
sure.
problem with statutory interpretation.
To be clear, forbearance serves a very important purpose, and it's a good thing that Congress included it in the statute. But as Brent just illustrated, our argument was fundamentally different. We're not opposed to forbearance per se, and it sure beats the alternative once the the FCC has decided to reclassify. But the fact that the FCC had to, as it said at one point in its order, go beyond typical forbearance proceedings and exercise what they called, throughout the order, extensive forbearance, broad forbearance, expansive forbearance, showed that they really were going further than they ever had to sort of, set parts of the framework aside in order to allow the basic reclassification to remain coherent. And, as the court suggested in Utility or Regulatory Group with the EPA, once an agency has to start doing that, has to really start changing the entire framework in order to make its underlying program fit, they really should take a step back and ask the more fundamental question of whether their underlying statutory interpretation makes sense in the first place. So again, it's not a problem with forbearance per se, but rather this sort of radical degree of forbearance should have been a red flag to the agency that it had headed down the wrong statutory path in the first place.
Yeah, because we're actually seeing that through a number of interveners in a number of cases. I know you mentioned edge providers, where you have, and I don't know if you guys are very familiar with telecom, but you have, Looking Glass, which became Level 3, and Level 3 is now going through a number of, what do they call those, access points where they, Brett, can you help me out here, where they share connection points?
Interconnection points.
Interconnection points, and they're saying, provider A and provider B, we have so many ports on the switch, if you don't put an extra port in there, level 3 versus AT&T or Verizon or whomever, you're violating net neutrality in those cases, where there's definitely an added cost to, support the infrastructure and everything else. It's just interesting, it's definitely a big change in the direction that the FCC has had in the past, for sure.
And to take a step back to the biggest of big pictures, to look at the modern debates we have across agencies with respect to non-enforcement of laws and so-called prosecutorial discretion or waiver, there comes a point where if an agency is asserting sort of broad regulatory power in general, but then claims sort of massive power to waive laws here and there with respect to certain sort of favored aspects of the industry, it does raise sort of fundamental questions that Richard Epstein has flagged in an article he wrote for National Affairs, and many others have raised elsewhere about sort of the nature of government and administration, the rule of law, fairness, and due process. If what this comes down to is government in two steps, the first step being a massive regulatory power grab, and the second step being the retention of power to pick and choose who to actually apply it to on a case-by-case basis, it really does undermine basic notions of the rule of law and fundamental fairness.
Epstein called it
government by waiver.
Let me make a final call for questions here. If you have a question, now's the time to push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We still have a few minutes left. I do see another question, so check in with another caller. Two more questions, so go right ahead, caller.
Alden Abbott from Heritage Foundation. Quick question. I may have missed the beginning of the call, but any prospects for CERT and also the prospects of the new commission might take a different perspective on the whole open internet set of issues?
Well, there are, you know, there are at least three paths that the petitioners and interveners on both sides of the case, both the ones challenging the FCC for doing what it did and the petitioners challenging it for not going far enough. You know, the three choices obviously are panel rehearing, en banc rehearing, and a cert petition. You know, those are all on the table. Of course, the parties to the case will need to decide for themselves and you know, collectively what to do. As I mentioned at the outset, and this is Adam, I, you know, in addition to my work at Hoover, I'm part of the legal team for interveners, Tech Freedom et al., and so Tech Freedom will need to make a decision, as will, I'm sure, Brent's clients and all the other petitioners in the case.
Yeah, in terms of the latter part of your question, what would a new administration do or a new FCC chair do? Yeah, I think it all hinges on the election. The Republican commissioners on the FCC have been strongly opposed to the net neutrality and Title II regulation. So if there's a Republican president in the fall, the Republican president would appoint a new chair, and there would be three Republicans and two Democrats on the FCC. They would have all options on the table to repeal the open internet order. So that, you know, elections have consequences, and certainly did in 2008 and 2012. So we'll just have to see what happens with the election, and I presume if a Democrat wins, then net neutrality would remain the law of the land.
By the way, Brett, it's my understanding that Commissioner Pai, who's been one of the most outspoken critics within the commission of this policy, that his term ends at the end of June, right? Is there any word on who'll be teed up to replace him?
I don't know, Adam. I think I don't know exactly how those rules work, but I think oftentimes a commissioner will remain in position even after the term ends. So it's not necessarily true that a new appointee would have to take his position. I think Rosenworcel's term has already expired, but she's still there.
Oh, okay.
We have one question pending, and I think enough time to handle it.
Thank you. Just the previous caller asked my question, and you answered it for me.
Very good. Well, thank you for calling in, nevertheless. Gentlemen, it looks like we are out of questions, but we've got a couple minutes left. Let me give you each a chance to wrap up and express any final thoughts you might have on the case. Let's start, as we proceed in the beginning, with Brett Shumate.
Well, thanks, Dean, and thank you, Adam, for a lively discussion of the court's decision. I think there's a lot to digest in this court's opinion. From our perspective, we think the First Amendment analysis by the court was very significant, and I encourage everybody to read it and think about the implications. And the other really important issue we haven't gotten to talk about a whole lot today was the source of authority that the court relied on to uphold the open internet rules. I thought it was significant that the court upheld the FCC's reliance on Title II, but they did not look to any of the specific provisions of Title II to uphold any of the rules. Even though the commission unlocked this massive power under 201 and 202, the majority did not even attempt to sustain the open internet rules under 201 or 202, but then instead fell back to Section 706 of the Telecom Act of 96, which was at issue in the Verizon case. So I thought that was significant, that this was an issue that Judge Williams had raised in dissent, that Section 201 and 202 would not authorize the paid prioritization rule. The majority didn't even engage on that issue and relied on Section 706. So right now that stands as the only source of authority for the open internet rules, notwithstanding reclassification under Title II. So a lot of interesting issues in this court's opinion, a lot more to discuss, but happy to talk about those issues today.
Yeah, and for me, I just say as this litigation winds its way through the D.C. Circuit and beyond, I find it just a fascinating case, both as a participant and as an observer of sort of the broader title shifts in administrative law. In recent years, we've seen some pretty fundamental questions raised by folks like Justice Scalia, the late Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas, in a series of opinions last year about rethinking aspects of deference in administrative law. And it's not just the originalists or even the conservatives, because as I mentioned, you know, some of these questions about the application of Chevron deference and its limits and its necessary limits are found in King v. Berwick. Orwell in an opinion, you know, authored by Chief Justice Roberts, but signed by all of the liberals on the court. So it'll be interesting to see in this case and in other cases such as the EPA Clean Power Plan, other cases involving Chevron deference or other fundamental issues of administrative law, how this discussion among the justices and the judges of the lower courts continue, the extent to which the justices follow through on their criticisms or pare them back, you know, for example, in this case, the extent to which the justices would hold fast to what they said in King v. Burwell, or whether that proves to be a ticket good for only one ride. No one knows, but it's a very interesting and exciting time, not just in telecommunications law, but in administrative law more generally, and it'll be interesting to see what happens next.
Well, gentlemen, on behalf of the Federal Society, I thank you both for joining us today. It's been very interesting, especially for joining us on such short notice. To our audience, a reminder that next week is a decision week for the Supreme Court, the next to last week, so we will be scheduling teleforum calls according to the opinions that come out. But until our next scheduled teleforum conference call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.